God bless you, and welcome to Spirit and Truth Fellowship International's audio podcast. Our goal is to provide you with Bible-based teachings that will help you walk in a transforming relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. We hope you will be inspired by what you're about to hear.
Welcome to this teaching, which I've titled Understanding the Nature of the Enemy. My name is Dan Gallagher, and this teaching falls within the broader topic of the spiritual battle. There's a number of Christians that do understand that there is a spiritual battle which has been raging between God and his arch enemy, an enemy we know by the name of Satan or the devil. But many Christians are not aware exactly of the nature of this enemy. That is, what he's like, what he does, what are some of his tactics and his motives. Well, in this teaching, we're going to take time to look at some specific things which God has revealed to us about his enemy so that we can be more effective in our stand against him. After all, if we're going to be able to stand effectively against God's enemy, we're going to need to understand to at least some degree who it is and what it is that we're standing against. Governments around the world spend billions of dollars annually on military intelligence. They attempt to gather information about the enemies of their state. In the United States of America, we have the Central Intelligence Agency. We also have an organization called the National Security Agency, or NSA. Every government around the world has an intelligence arm. And their intent is to understand the nature of their enemy, those that oppose them, those that are actively seeking to harm the peoples of their nations. What do they do when they gather intelligence? Well, they try to look at who are the enemies of their state, what are their capabilities, what is their size, what is their technical capacity, what are the maneuvers or ways in which they're going to go about and launch an attack against them. In the same way, God has revealed to us many things which we can be wise about concerning his enemy, which is our enemy too. Before I get into the heart of this teaching and we look at some of the ways in which God has revealed this information to us, I'd like to just talk for a second and put this in some context. The other day as I was reflecting on doing this teaching, it struck me that God's enemy is really like a bully. That kind of resonates for me because when I was younger, I experienced some bullying. Maybe you have too. Many people do experience bullying, or sometimes we've even bullied other people. What is it that bullies do? Well, I went out and did a search on the internet on some of the characteristics of bullies, and I want to read these to you, and as I do, I want you to think about them and reflect on how they apply to God's enemy, Satan. First, bullies think highly of themselves. Well, that's certainly true of God's enemy. They also have trouble following rules. They're generally physically big or strong. They use their power to intimidate. They like being looked up to. They expect others to comply and to behave to their wishes. And they really don't care how their actions affect others because they lack compassion. And they always look for an easy target. My goodness, when I sat and looked at these characteristics, every one of those applies to God's enemy. He is nothing but a bully. So how do you effectively stand up to a bully? Well, first of all, you have to act with confidence. And to do that, you have to have knowledge. Generally, what happens is you become aware that the bully really doesn't have the power he wants you to think he has. You begin to connect with the ways in which he tries to intimidate. You also see how he's seeking out those that are an easy target, so then you can do things so that you don't become a target for him. Ignorance of Satan's moves, ignorance of his, what the King James calls his devices, puts us in a susceptible position to be bullied, to be strong-armed by this guy. But the fact is, he has been defeated. We have the high ground. We stand on a solid footing. So we need to understand the nature of this enemy if we're going to be able to defeat him in our lives. Oftentimes, a smaller fighting force can be more effective against a strong opponent if they have good intelligence. We are in a spiritual battle, and being a Christian is not going to be enough. Yes, we've been endued with power from on high. We have Christ in us. We have all the enablements that God could possibly give us to defeat this enemy. But they're going to be useless if we don't understand how to use them and how it is that he works against us. We've got to understand his methods. We've got to understand his tactics and the nature of the enemy itself for us to be effective in our defense and offense against him. I shared this topic a number of weeks ago in our own home fellowship, our small house church, and my wife Lori came up to me afterwards and she said, "You know, honey, talking about this enemy of God's, Satan, the devil, it just kind of creeps me out." Well, I understand that. I don't want to do anything in any way to embellish or to laud this guy, to lift him up. He is our enemy as well as God's. So let's put this in proper context. If we're going to talk about the enemy, let's keep in the forefront of our minds that he's been defeated. Galatians 5:1 says, "It is for freedom that Christ has set us free. Stand firm then, and do not let yourselves be burdened again by a yoke of slavery." The emphasis that I see in that verse at this point is, do not let yourselves be burdened. If we're ignorant of Satan's devices, then we're in a position that we're allowing him to burden us with a yoke of slavery. Christ has set us free. Let's always remember that. And let's not give up our winning position. Armies around the world always seek to take the high ground. It's the better ground to fight from. It's easier to fight an opponent when he has to work and try to struggle uphill. We have the high ground. Let's not let Satan defeat us by pushing us off this high ground. Many times, if we yield the high ground, it's because we choose to do so. Also, 1 John chapter 4, verse 4, we need to keep in our mind, "You, dear children, are from God and have," past tense, "we have overcome them, because the one who is in you," is in the present tense, "is greater than the one who is in the world." We have overcome them. Let's never forget that. Let's never let it go out of our mind that we have the high ground. And then also, Romans 8:37, "No, in all of these things," referring to the previous things that God listed in the verses directly preceding, it says, "we are," present tense, "more than conquerors through him who loved us." Satan wants nothing more than to trick us, to deceive us, to get us to yield the high ground. Colossians 1:13, "For he," Jesus, "has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves." I said that first he was Jesus. It's really not. It's referring to God. But the point I'm making is that we have been rescued. If you were thrown into a jail cell, just picture yourself maybe in an old Western jail cell. You know, one of those with the block walls, the adobe walls, the small little window, and the cast iron grates. And all of a sudden, that cell door is closed. Well, along comes the sheriff. He turns the key and he unlocks the door. He says, "You're free to go, son." Now, it's your choice if you're going to stay in that jail cell and or if you're going to believe the sheriff and push the door open and walk out. Your freedom's been granted. Are you going to live in it, or are you going to believe the lie that maybe someone else might want to tell you that, well, you're really not free. The sheriff's just trying to trick us. We have been freed, and let's never forget that. And also, Luke 10:19, Jesus said, "I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Not part of the power and not sometimes, but you can overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing, absolutely nothing will harm you. Nothing will harm you provided you stand on the high ground. It's only going to be ignorance of Satan and his nature, his devices, his schemes that will allow him to defeat us. One of the best ways to understand the nature of our enemy is to be able to look at the various ways in which God describes him. And the way that God does this is he gives him different names. Now, I use the word names kind of loosely because they're really not names. They're what we call appellations. An appellation is like a title. If someone referred to me as Dan the Blacksmith, well, today we might have the last name of Blacksmith, but there was a time where that was really an appellation. In other words, from that last name, Blacksmith, you knew that I was a worker of iron, that I would pound, you know, things into shovels or horseshoes, because my name was really a title, and that title gave you insight into my vocation. We also refer to John the Baptist or Jesus of Galilee. See, those are appellations. They're ways in which describing that in the Old Testament times, if you called him John the Baptist, then you would know that he was the man who was out, that guy out in the wilderness, and he was, baptizing people in the Jordan River versus John of Nazareth or John of Jerusalem or something else like that. In the same way, God has given us various descriptive terms which give us insight actually into the nature of this enemy. Now, some people have said, well, wait a minute, I thought his name is Satan. No, that's not his name. That's a title, and we will discuss that, and it describes a certain aspect of his nature. Someone else once said, well, I thought his name was Lucifer. No, again, Lucifer is not his name. Lucifer actually means son of the dawn and has been at times translated light bearer, but it's not a name. It's an appellation, a descriptive term. The first term that I want to look at is the term God of this age. When God uses the phrase God of this age, it gives us insight into his nature. Let's look at this in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. It says, "The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." Well, specifically in this verse, we see how he opposes God and he attempts to blind the minds of unbelievers so that they can't see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. But the God of this age is a phrase which refers to his primary goal. As a God, he seeks to be worshiped. Now, when I say God, of course, I'm using the small g. It's not capitalized as in the God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, who's the God that we worship. But he seeks worship as a God, small g. This desire for worship is an outgrowth of his sin of pride. It also gives us insight, this phrase, God of this age, into the fact that he has some power and some authority. Let's go to Matthew 4. And in verse 4 through 10, there's a section where you can see how he seeks this worship as the God of this age. "Again, the devil took him, Jesus, to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their splendor. All this I will give you, he said." Well, there's his power and authority. He certainly has something to give if he's offering it. And then the condition was, "If you will bow down and worship me." Thankfully, Jesus answered saying, "Get away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only." See, there in this section in Matthew 4:4 is a direct reference of how the God of this age seeks to be worshiped. It is basically one of his primary natures, which is idolatry. Ezekiel 14:4 says, "Therefore speak to them and tell them, This is what the sovereign Lord, Yahweh, says. When any Israelite sets up idols in his heart, that's what this God of his age is always seeking to do. He hates God. He hates the fact that God is worshiped as the supreme being. And so he seeks to draw that worship, which is rightfully due to Yahweh, our heavenly creator. He seeks to draw that worship away and to have us to set up idols, to worship anything other than the true God. Pride is what's at the center of this idolatry. Pride in the sense of it's my way, not God's way. Pride is just something that oozes from the devil. It comes out of his pore. He is so filled with his own self-worth. That's what pride is, where he focuses so much on his self-worth. Pride in the Hebrew is the word which is used to describe a smoke as it rises or lifts up. Pride is a lifting up of self. In Webster's, it's defined as an inordinate self-esteem, a conceit about one's own superiority in talents, wealth, accomplishments, power, rank, or office. Well, that's exactly what this enemy of God wants to do. The God of this age is always seeking to bring about an inordinate self-esteem, a focus on superiority in our own talents, our own wealth or accomplishments, our own power, rank, or office. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, has a wonderful section which gives us insight into this God of this age. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. Now that's the word Lucifer, actually. And there it is. See, it's giving us another sense. But that, again, is not his name. He's the son of the dawn. That's another teaching which gives us different aspects of him. We won't go into it now. But I want to focus here on the following verses. It says, you have been cast down to heaven, you who once laid low the nations. You, this son of the dawn, said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the mount of the assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. I will ascend to the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High God. Five times this son of the dawn, Lucifer, says, I will. I will ascend, I will raise, I will sit on God's throne, I will ascend above the tops of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. See, this is his pride. This is his nature as the God of this age, to be worshiped, to be idolized, and he promotes idolatry in the sense of to draw men's away reverence and honor, glory given to the true God, the creator of the heavens and the earth. He does anything he can to pull people away. This sense of pride has infected mankind ever since the fall of Adam. Consider the sin of Cain. In Genesis chapter 4, here's Cain who's already, he's envying of his brother. He has contempt for his brother. Pride is often demonstrated through contempt. Contempt is when you treat others with disdain, or you consider others to be worth less than what they really are. You look down on them. It's a state of being despised. It's one of the strongest opinions that we can have negatively of other people. Whenever there is pride, there is usually found to be some form of contempt for other people. And I will guarantee you, there can be no contempt without pride. When Goliath came out and he approached David, he spoke with him with contempt against him. That record's in 1 Samuel 17. It says in verse 42, he despised him. He literally had contempt for David, for the armies of Israel, and for the God Yahweh himself. This sin of pride always produces sins like murder. Shortly after Cain murders Abel, God comes and says, where's your brother? What does Cain do? He lies. See, the God of this world is always about self. He's promoting an egocentrism, and it always produces unforgiveness, murder, theft, lying. Pride, as the god of this age, is one of the main weapons in his arsenal. When pride comes, it blinds minds. That's what Obadiah says. You know, when there's pride, in Proverbs 13:10, it says, then it breeds quarrels. Also, when pride comes, there will always be a fall, a disgrace. In Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Pride always hurts, always harms, always shuts down relationships. And as the god of this age, it's his pride, his lifting himself up, which is one of his main weapons. That's one of the main natures of this enemy. The second appellation I'd like to look at is the reference to Satan. In the Greek, it's actually the word satana, and all it means is the adversary. Now, many of us have referred to God's enemy as the adversary, but we don't connect with the fact that really the word the adversary is what Satan means. We had already read previously in this teaching where it says Satan came. You know, or no, Jesus, when he was when Satan attempted to tempt him with worshiping him, he says, you know, get away from me, Satan, for it is written. See, it's the adversary. He was coming as God's adversary. As an adversary, he opposes God and everything about God. He opposes the truth. We can see all throughout the Old Testament how the devil is constantly attempting to hinder the plans of God, seeking to kill off the bloodline through which the Messiah would come. You know, he's an adversary. He is the enemy. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8 says, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so also these men oppose the truth, men of depraved minds, who as far as the faith is concerned are rejected. This is what the adversary, Satan, does. He opposes. He's an adversary. In fact, the word oppose is one of the ways in which God refers to him. And it's as the opposer, this is a category that falls underneath the term the adversary or Satan. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3 says, don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs. The man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. This is Satan, the adversary's man. Verse 4 goes on and says, he will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Now, as I read these verses, you will see that there's an intertwining in the nature of this enemy of God. Oftentimes, within one verse, there'll be multiple references to his various natures. When we read in Matthew how he comes and he wants to be worshipped, he's showing up as the God of this age, and then Jesus is referring to him as the adversary. Here in 2 Thessalonians, we see where he opposes and he also exalts. It's almost like, in many ways, like a soccer ball. You know, if you think of a soccer ball, the traditional soccer ball is black and white and has all those little patches and those very, you know, I think they're hexagons or something. They form the shape of the soccer ball. Well, there's one enemy of God. What we're doing is we're focusing on different spots on that soccer ball, but they're all intertwined. As the God of this world, he's opposing the true God. That's why he's called Satan, the adversary. See, so we have the adversary, the opposer, the God of this age. And then we also see how the pride plays. We begin to get a picture of this very nature. So don't be surprised when opposition comes against you. I guess that's part of the point that we should take home here. Because he is an opposer. If you think you're doing well, walking with God, well, then sometimes that's the time when you need to be most concerned. I know when it's, I kind of put myself in neutral and I think, well, everything's going fine. Woo, that's the time when I really sometimes have to kind of like take an extra sip of coffee and wake up a little bit. It reminds me of the story of a seminary school president one time. What his habit was is he would bring in the various students and he'd interview them throughout the semester. Well, the story goes that one day he brings in a young man, sits him down, he checks in with him, how are your classes going, how are your teachers, are you staying on top of your assignment, how are your finances, how's your relationships with your other students? Well, to every question he asked, the student responded, you know, they're fine, everything's great, things are going well, it's perfect. The president looks at him and says, you know, son, I'm really concerned for you. Student, shocked, looks at him and says, concerned for me? I just told you, everything's going well. Why would you be concerned for me? President said, that's exactly my point. If you're really standing for God, if you're really actively moving and working and walking in the ways of God, you should have some opposition in your life. There should be some things that are going against you. You know, too often as Christians, we've kind of fallen into this trap thinking that because we're standing for God, everything should be perfect. Well, that's exactly opposite of what Jesus Christ said. He said, you shall suffer persecution. Now, I'm not saying that we, you know, don't have the spiritual weapons to be victorious, but the fact is, if you're pressing hard for God, you're going to get a lot of pressure coming against you. Isn't that the lesson that we can learn from the Apostle Paul's life? Go read Corinthians sometimes where it talks about how many times he was whipped, beaten with rods, a night and a day in the deep. You know, one time he shows up on an island, he's just putting firewood on a fire and out jumps a snake and bites him in the hand. The other day I was getting in touch with the fact that, you know, in 2004, I closed a business of mine in California and moved to the Midwest to go full-time into service for God. It was a door that was opening to me, and I felt that it was something that the Lord was behind and that it was what I was being called to do. I have to honestly say, though, I have never come against more personal, physical, spiritual opposition in my life than since that decision to do this. For many times, I thought to myself, what am I doing wrong? Why is there so much that's coming against me? Then one day I realized that's the wrong question. I should expect things to be coming against me if I'm really moving forward with God. Now, granted, sometimes persecution or opposition, you know, things that happen against us in life are because we're making stupid choices. We're not being wise. We're living as fools. But if you've checked yourself and you're not doing that, and you really are still getting tremendous opposition, well, then that's the time where you stand in faith and you oppose that opposition and you don't back down, because that's exactly what God's enemy wants us to do. He wants us to get knocked off the high ground. Look at the opposition in the Word of God. My goodness, Joseph with his brothers sold into slavery. How about once sold into slavery and then elevated to a position of responsibility in Potiphar's household, and then Potiphar's wife comes against him? Then he's thrown into prison. Not only is he into prison, he gets elevated into prison, and then his heart gets knocked down again when the two people he interprets dreams for don't even remember him. Or how about the record of Nehemiah, the opposition that came against him with Sambalat, Tobiah, and Geshem? That record's in Nehemiah 4. If you're undergoing some opposition, then just check yourself. Where's that opposition coming from? And be honest with yourself. Is it because you're being foolish and unwise in choices that you're making? Or is it because you're really pressing hard for God? Because opposition's going to come, and it can come from both sources. But if you're pressing hard for God, then hang in there. Don't give up the high ground. It happened with Esther and Mordecai. Haman opposed the entire nation of all the Jews. He wanted them annihilated. David, Goliath, once he defeated Goliath, his life wasn't perfect. Look at, he lived 12, 13, 14 years or more in the desert trying to evade Saul, who was trying to kill him. You know, here he gets anointed with oil by Samuel over his head. At that point, I would think that that's a high point in a person's life. Anointed to be the king of Israel? Oh my gosh, then he has to go on the run just to save his own skin. Opposition is what is going to be part of the package. If you're standing for God, be prepared, because Satan is the adversary, and he is against you, and he's against God, and he's against anything that stands for God. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 14, the record says, "So I counsel younger widows to marry, to have children, to manage their homes, and to give the enemy no opportunity for slander. Some have, in fact, already turned away to follow Satan, the adversary." This word enemy is the word antikieme, and it means to set against, to oppose. That's who he is, and it's his nature. So one of the things we can learn about this enemy of God is that he opposes. The third appellation that I want to look at is the term the tempter. This is huge. Matthew chapter 4, verse 3 says, "The tempter came to him and said, 'If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread.'" This guy does everything he can. If he can't push you off the high ground by pressuring you off through his opposition, then he's going to try to lure you off. See, after all, we can either get pushed off the high ground through pressure, or we can step off the high ground by making wrong choices. And the way he gets us to make wrong choices is by tempting us. In Luke chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit in the desert, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing during those days, and at the end of them he was hungry. The devil said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, tell this stone to become bread.'" Well, there's an entire teaching just on this section alone. The point I want to make, though, is he is constantly seeking ways to tempt. In this specific section, he tempted first by going after Jesus' physical needs. You know, basically like, he knew he was hungry. He hadn't eaten for 40 days. Well, the same is with us. He is going to tempt you in all areas of your life concerning your physical needs. One of the most basic desires of the human heart is the desire to be safe. Well, safety comes by knowing that we have a roof over our head, money in the bank, food on the table, clothing on our backs. We desire to be safe. So he is going to tempt you, to lure you by providing those things to you in ways which are not coming from God, by getting you to focus inordinately on your safety, on food, on money, on shelter. See, it's part of the scheme of temptation. Another way he tempted was to offer him basically power, authority, position, and toys. He brought him in and he shows him all of these things in the kingdoms of the world. Satan has a plan designed for each and every one of us specifically. He knows who you are, and he knows your weaknesses. He knows your family history. He knows your temperament. He knows your dispositions. He understands your fears. He goes after your weaknesses. He's a master at temptation. It's almost as if he has a master dossier on each one of us. As the tempter, he has manipulated the atmosphere of this age. The Greek word is called the aeon, because he's the god of this age. He sets up the entire world to offer nothing but lures. When thinking about this whole temptation field, we have to be very, very careful, very judicious in our actions. I'd like to go to Haggai chapter 2 and go to verse 12 and 13 with me. There's a very powerful lesson that we have to understand, that holiness is not infectious. In verse 2, it says, "If a person carries consecrated meat in the fold of his garment, and that fold touches some bread, stew, wine, oil, or food, does it become consecrated?" The priests answered no. The point, see, holiness, this consecrated meat in the fold of the garment, when that touched another object, it didn't make that object holy. Then Haggai goes on in verse 13, if a person defiled by contact with a dead body touches one of these things, does it become defiled? Yes, the priest replied, it becomes defiled. See, unholiness, this defiled person, that is infectious. It's almost, I think, in terms of, it's like if I came to you with muddy, soiled clothing, grease and oil all over me, if I touch a clean cloth, does that cloth make me become clean? Absolutely not. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get that greasy oil mud, that soil on me, onto the clean cloth. That's what this tempter has done. He's designed the world to be unholy. We cannot be passive in this. If we enter into the world, which we are in this world, and we being holy, we have got to be aggressive in our holiness. Otherwise, the uncleanness of the world will make us unclean in the sense that it will affect us. That's how this temptation works. He's designed a world full of temptation. We can't just passively go around being holy thinking that we're going to affect the world. It doesn't work that way. The world will affect us. Now, I understand that in our spirit, in the gift that we have, we are righteous, we are justified, we are holy. Yet the choices we make, we have to be aggressive in them to live that holiness. Because if we don't, then we will act in evil ways. It's how he's designed the world. We have to get in touch with when we're hungry, when we're angry, when we're lonely, tired, or stressed. That's when we're most vulnerable to this. One of the big lies that Satan promotes out there as a part of his temptation is, oh, just do it this one time, just this one time. Jesus, just bow down to me this one time and I'll give this to you. Don't do it. The fact is that the world is unholy and you become unclean in that moment when you yield to it. You know, just look at this pornography just once, or just look at that image or dwell on that woman one time. Men, don't do it, because what it is it takes you down a path that it builds, it escalates. We cannot just smoke dope just one time, because when you do, you've dropped your resistance to it. Just take one hit. That's what the tempter's trying to get you to do. Oh, you know, just this one time. Just go a little bit further in your relationship with this girl. If you're a young guy and a young girl unmarried, oh, just go a little bit further. Or just look a little longer on this image. He will tempt you and tempt you and tempt you, but you cannot yield. You cannot give him any ground, because evil will always infect. Holiness isn't infectious. Holiness can affect, but we have to be very, very strong in that stance of holiness for us to affect others around us. Otherwise, we become infected. I think of it as someone who is almost diseased. If I had tuberculosis or smallpox and I came into a room of healthy people, is my being in their presence going to make me healthy? Absolutely not. That's the lesson of Haggai. Whereas what I need to do is I need to get basically, you know, just cleansed and healed from the inside. But their holiness is not going to infect me. My tendency is I'm going to infect them and make them all sick. We've got to be aggressive in making the right choices. We can't think that we can just know what's right and then purposely not do it, and that there's not going to be consequences or results for that. When we do nothing, evil takes over, and the tempter is always out there trying to get us to yield, to give up, just this one time. The word says so clearly, as a man thinks, so is he. So as the tempter, he is trying to manipulate our thinking, to get us to think like the ways of the world, like the God of this age that he is wants us to think. Christians have to stop living and thinking like the ways of the world. We've got to put off worldly attitudes and behaviors because they're being promoted by the tempter. The fourth appellation or term that I want to look at is the deceiver. As a deceiver, he is a liar. In John chapter 8, verse 44, Jesus, referring to a group of Pharisees that were around him, said, "You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there's no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he's a liar and the father of lies." Wow, this is big. When I first got connected with this, it was while I was helping people through various counseling sessions, I began to see how the devil, God's enemy, the Satan, the adversary, had come and had sown lies deep within the hearts of people. Lies that go way back, even to their youth and childhood. Lies about who they are. Lies about things that had been done to them. This is because as the God of this age, as the tempter, one of the tactics that he's doing is to sow lies. It's his native language. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 4, the record opens with him lying to Eve. "You will not surely die." The inference here is where he's tempting Eve. He's opposing God. Eve doesn't see it. She's innocent. She doesn't know it. But she yields to this temptation, and then all of a sudden, it's like, you know, God's word, "You shall surely die," gets changed by this liar to, "You will not surely die." Look at Genesis chapter 4, verse 9, with the record of Cain. Cain says, when God comes and he says, you know, it says in verse 9, "Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Where's your brother Abel?'" "I don't know." Cain's a liar. "What do you mean you don't know, Cain? You killed him and left his body out in the field." And then he comes back and he's speaking to God, the creator of the heavens and the earth. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Cain had already taken on the nature of God's enemy. Cain lied. He deflected the question. He is living like the serpent himself. Mankind has been under this curse of the serpent ever since the Garden of Eden. When I'm raising a couple little ones, these little kids, I was just amazed one day where a 2 or 3 year old lies. Where did they learn that? You ask them a question and you see their eyes going and the wheels in their mind going, and all of a sudden they lie about something that clearly you know as an adult that they did. It's because it's part of the very nature of us. He has sown lies into the very fabric of our hearts. In Revelation chapter 20, verse 7, it says, "When the 1,000 years are over, Satan, the adversary, will be released from his prison. He will go out to do what? To deceive the nations." He's a deceiver. That's part of just who he is. And he's going to do it by going into the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. There's your adversary. In number, they are like the sand of the seashore. Let's go to 2 John chapter 1, verse 7. It says, "Many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ is coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist." There's again, Antichrist as one who opposes God. Certainly, Jesus Christ is God's Son who's been given heaven, on earth, under the earth, and in heaven. You know, he sits at the right hand of God, and he opposes him, and he goes out to deceive the nations, and all they do is they speak lies. Don't be surprised when people lie about you. It's part of the tactics of the enemy. It's part of one of the very parts of his nature. It used to really bother me when I was, accused of things that I didn't do, and I'm not going to say it doesn't bother me today, because yes, of course it does. But he's going to lie. And one of the ways in which he lies is he lies through gossip, through slander, through murmuring, through backbiting. To lie, there's an implication that the mouth is involved. To see the insight that we can gain by just looking at the various ways in which God, uses to describe this guy. In Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20, it says, Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. As the God of this age, that is what he is doing. He's manipulating the world so that the good, the things of God, are considered wrong, bad. You know, I cannot tell you how many times I get emails of someone who's writing in, who's questioning whether it's okay to have sex outside of marriage or not. Young people who have actually, a mother wrote me the other day and said, I don't know what to tell my son. He's making up all these arguments. Well, that's because that's the way of the world. Now, all of a sudden, it's no big deal to shack up or to live with someone outside the covenant of a marriage. But let's be clear. God calls it fornication. He calls it sexual immorality to have sexual relations with another person outside the covenant of marriage. Either God is telling the truth or he's lying. Well, it's very clear that God's arch enemy, the adversary, Satan, the opposer, the God of this age, is a deceiver and he's tempting and he's doing everything he can to call good evil and evil good, bitter sweet and sweet bitter. There's no new thing under the sun. Isaiah told us very clearly back in chapter 5, verse 20, it's been one of his tactics from the beginning. He pulled the same thing on Eve, didn't he? Did God surely provide for you? Has God really care for you? Isn't God holding something back from you? He's a liar and he's a deceiver. And we have just got to be aggressive in our stance for holiness. The fifth way that God refers to him is as the accuser. He's called the accuser of the brethren. The word accuser in the Greek is the word kategoreo, and it means to accuse in the sense of as to be a prosecutor, one who comes before a judge, to lay charges against a person. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, it says, "For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down." A number of months ago, John Shainhite, my co-worker here, did a wonderful teaching on the topic of what is going on in heaven now. I encourage you to listen to that because that will give you greater insight as to what is going on and how this accuser of the brethren still has access to the throne of God. And when he comes before God, he does nothing but lay charges against us before God. Look at how closely they watched Jesus, quote, so they might accuse him, unquote. False accusations, false charges, it's no news. It's a large weapon in his arsenal. He'll even tell the truth about a person if he can do it to slime them. Which leads me to the next term that God uses. He's called the slanderer. Many people don't understand that the word the devil actually means the slanderer. Just as Satan meant the accuser, the devil means the slanderer. The word devil is a translation of the Greek word to diabolos, and it just means to slander. To slander is when I spread falsehoods, I inflame things with the intent of destroying another person's reputation. I've mentioned, you know, his use of gossip, backbiting, whispering, murmuring, grumbling. We've got to be very careful with our mouths because we can so easily play into Satan's hand, the adversary's hand, by his nature as the slanderer. John chapter 8, verse 44, when Jesus said, "You belong to your father, the devil," what he was saying is, "You belong to your father, the slanderer." And then he goes on and talks about all of those references to how his native language is lies. I want to remind you of the record of Aaron and Miriam when they complained about Moses. Why did they complain about Moses? Because they envied his position, his authority. They envied his relationship with God. What did they do? They slandered Moses. They murmured. They gossiped. They basically whispered and backbit in the sense of they're talking behind about him behind his back. The end result was Miriam was covered with leprosy. She demonstrated on the outside the unclean condition of her heart on the inside. That's what the slanderer is going to do. He's going to, as the tempter, tempt you to slander because he's going to play up to your own ego and pride. The last term that I want to look at is God's reference to him as the destroyer. In John chapter 10, verse 10, Jesus says, "The thief comes only to steal, to kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." The devil does nothing that's constructive. He is nothing but evil. He sows destruction. He wants to do nothing but destroy. Look at what happens when people follow the path of any kind of addiction, drug addictions, alcohol. You can just see the vacant, destroyed lives that he sows. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8 says, "Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour." See, this is his role as the destroyer. There's been times in my life where I've yielded to sin and followed the wrong path, only to find myself just at the bottom of the pit. That's because he wants to lure us in. He wants to suck us down the wrong path so that he can destroy us and prevent us from being effective for God. In Revelation chapter 9, verse 11, it says, "And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue, his name Apollyon." Apollyon, that is to say, a destroyer. It's also in the sense of, there's a reference to him being the dragon. The dragon, when you think about it mythologically, was a destroyer. It was a being that would lurk and fly at night, fire-breathing. See, this is his role, the dragon, the destroyer. We need to be clear that following him or his ways or the ways of his world as the God of this age will ultimately breed nothing but destruction. In this teaching, it's been my intent to focus upon the seven most fundamental ways in which God refers to his enemy, so that we can understand the essence and nature of who he is and how he operates. By looking at him as the God of this age, we can see how he desires worship, how pride lives in his heart, and how he promotes idolatry. We've seen that he is the adversary, the enemy of God. He opposes God, God's way, his truth, and anyone who stands for God. We've also looked at him as a tempter. That's one of the ways in which he opposes God. How he manipulates the world, the ways of the world, and everything around us to get us to step off the high ground that Jesus Christ's blood paid for, that he has bought for us, that we now can stand upon a solid foundation. He's also a deceiver, an accuser, the slanderer, and the destroyer. There's other ways in which God refers to him. For instance, in the Old Testament, he's referred to as Azazel, which is the goat god. He's also referred to as Belial or Belial, which we believe means the worthless one. He's referred to as Beelzebub, which is the lord of the flies. He's also called the Wicked One, the Prince of this world, and the Ruler of the Air. It's been, like I said, my intention that by looking at the seven most dominant ones or fundamental ones, that we can learn the most significant ways in which he operates. But being a Christian has to be much more than just accepting Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. It's almost like that's the ticket that gets us into the ball game. But now it's our job to step up to the plate and to be able to swing the bat, to play the game. We've got to be more concerned about our Christianity than just wearing a Jesus t-shirt, having the jewelry, or the bumper sticker on the back of the car. Jesus Christ died so that we would live like him. That is, we would live according to this new nature of Christ in us, so that we could take on this enemy because we've got the power. We've got the spiritual enablements. We need to be spiritually in shape if we're going to fight effectively. Some people get fat on the word because they are ever eating but never exercising. Those that are always learning but never doing. We need to eat and move and be lean and mean in this battle against our enemy. We can be aggressive in our holiness, in our stance for God. Believe me, the devil will take every foothold he can to enter into your life. Casting out devils? Really, that's no big deal. The point is, we have that power, but we've got to be active in our stance for God. Passive will not make it. The devil is actively opposing God and his truth. We need to be just as active and aggressive in our holiness. He's working to lull Christians into being dumb and complacent. Apathy will get us every time. Jesus didn't die so we could just barely get by. Colossians 2:15 says, "And having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross." Don't give away your position of strength. Don't step off the high ground. Jesus Christ died so that we could have life to the full. And in order to do that, we need to be wise as to the nature of the enemy.
The teaching you just heard was a presentation of Spirit and Truth Fellowship International. For further study, we encourage you to visit our research website, truthortradition.com. If you would like to get your copy of this teaching on CD or tape, you can go online at our home website, stfonline.org/store, or call us toll-free at 888-255-6189. Again, that's 888-255-6189. God bless you.